well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Are you feeling nervous? I'm feeling a little nervous. You know, the Supreme Court meeting behind closed doors today for their weekly conference. They're discussing a number of cases, including the multiple challenges to the Protect Illinois Communities Act. That's the state of Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. They are considering Bianchi versus Brown. That is the challenge to Maryland's so-called assault weapons ban. They're also considering Schrauer versus New York City. We talked about that case earlier in the week, taking on New York's good moral character clause to be issued a premises permit for your rifles or shotguns. Again, all three of these cases debated in conference today. There's no guarantee that the court is going to take any of them, but I think it's fair to say that expectations are high that the court is going to grant cert or do something beyond delaying acceptance of these gun ban cases. So we're talking about this with Chuck Michel on today's program. He is the head of the California Rifle and Pistol Association. He is also one of the founders of the Second Amendment Law Center. And he is one of the lead counsels, actually, in one of the Illinois cases, taking on the Protect Illinois Communities Act. So, as you can imagine, Chuck has a lot to say about the potential for the Supreme Court granting cert to one or more of these cases, as well as the other options that are available to the court, because it's not like they have to grant cert or they can just say no. There are actually a few things that the court could do with these cases. So, we'll start there. With that conversation with Chuck Michel, take a look and a listen. Chuck, thanks so much for joining me on the program today. Glad to see you got the black shirt memo. I was hoping that you'd receive that in time for the interview.
You know, that's my CRPA shirt, yeah. I have a black one and a navy one.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad
that the fashion plate.
I'm glad you went with the formal black attire here today. All right, so we are taping this on Wednesday afternoon, but this is going to be airing on Thursday. So by the time our audience hears this, the Supreme Court will have held its conference. We won't know if they've decided anything yet, but what are your thoughts, Chuck? I mean, do you feel pretty good that the court is going to accept or both of these gun ban cases?
Well, there's I think, three or four out of Illinois, and then Bianchi.
Yeah, I'm kind of lumping them all together. I'm talking about the PICA challenges. One. And the third one is Schrauer versus New York City, which is New York City's good moral character requirement for shotguns and long gun licenses, premises licenses.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of punditry going on about what the Supreme Court is thinking in terms of how it processes cases, both on the formal docket. Remember, Supreme Court has the classical way to try and get a case reviewed is you file a petition for a writ of certiorari. Then they take the case. They don't have to. They reject it 95% of the time. They just don't take the case, or they can take it. And the other docket is called the shadow docket, where you try and get emergency orders. And there's been a lot of coverage lately in the legal press about some of the judges are making comments about how the shadow docket works and when they should actually get involved through the shadow docket, or when they should just not get involved, you know, at all, or just let things work their way through, percolate through the lower courts first. So it's kind of unsettled about what they're thinking. Now, these are not shadow docket cases. These are cases that petition for writ of cert, but most of them petition for cert before judgment. Usually it's an interlocutory appeal from a preliminary injunction denial, which is not unusual for the Supreme Court to take those cases. But a lot of times, the Supreme Court likes to take a case after the record has been fully worked out, all the evidence has been admitted in the trial court, then the legal issues have been resolved or addressed at the Court of Appeal. So there's a richer record for them to bite into. So that's the kind of the procedural reasons why we might not get review.
Okay.
The practical reasons why we might get review is, I got to think, I know at least Justice Thomas and Alito are fed up. You know, the lower courts are basically thumbing their nose at them again, just like they did after Heller. But after Heller, we had Justice Kennedy on the court. And the kind of the conventional wisdom is that he didn't want to take a Second Amendment case. Remember, you have to have four judges to take one, five to win. They were afraid he didn't want to take another Second Amendment case. So we didn't get any of these cases that we asked the Supreme Court to take after Heller and before Bruin. We didn't get any of those accepted for 12 years. But now we have six, even though one or two might be a little squishy, in favor of the Second Amendment. And also, I think, tired of the lower courts basically thumbing their nose at the Bruin ruling. And I think they also know that the other side is playing the long game. The other side is hoping that Biden wins and that some of the older justices, one or more, will have to retire and Biden will get to put another justice in there and change the vote around. And so I think they're probably inclined to try and do something sooner rather than later so that they can set the record straight. So, it's, you know, it's all tea leaves and these are all floating around in the pot, you know, so who knows what they really mean. And then the wild card in there is the Rahimi case. And what are they going to say about Bruin's methodology in that case? Are they going to take that case as an opportunity to set the procedures straight that lower courts are supposed to file when evaluating the constitutionality of a gun control law on the second, under the Second Amendment? They may not take any of these cases because they think they're going to address the questions in Rahimi. Most likely, if that was the case, they would hold these cases. Then when Rahimi came down, they would grant review, vacate the lower court judgments, and remand them back down for consideration in light of Rahimi, just like they did to a lot of cases that were pent, that were boxed up in the Supreme Court when Bruin came down.
One of those being the Maryland gunman case that is being considered in conference, right? Bianchi versus Brown was one of those cases that was GVR'd, and now it's back up before the court. And, you know, again, you talk about the games being played. So you've got different games being played in the Seventh Circuit and the Fourth Circuit. The Seventh Circuit, go ahead.
And the Ninth.
And the Ninth, yes. we can talk about the Second Circuit. We can talk about all kinds of circuits. I'm just talking about specifically the circuits that are at issue here. You know, the Seventh Circuit, you had that three-judge panel, I think it was Judge Easterbrook writing for the majority, that said, well, Illinois' gun ban is fine because AR-15s aren't protected by the Second Amendment. They're like machine guns. And, you know, guns that are like machine guns aren't protected by the Second Amendment. The Fourth Circuit's a little bit different. They took that case that was GVR'd. A three-judge panel heard oral arguments in December of 2022. More than a year goes by. We don't have an opinion. And then all of a sudden, the Fourth Circuit says, you're not going to see that opinion because we're taking this case en banc. We've decided all of us are going to hear this case. That's an extraordinary step for an appeals court to do. And I, again, we're reading tea leaves here, but that does seem to me to be the type of legal offense machination that raises some eyebrows on the court, or should anyway.
Yes. And some of the things that even the Seventh Circuit did, that Easterbrook did, I mean, they're just twisting things so completely backwards to try and get the result they want. And yeah, you're right, Bianchi. They just skipped the three-judge panel, sat on that for over a year, and then when they were ready to rule, the en banc panel says, oh, never mind, we're taking it away from you. I mean, that is a procedural no-no, to put it mildly. just like, so, I mean, some of the briefs that were submitted urging the court to take the case, but their each of the cases, were really, I mean, they did no holds barred. I mean, it was, you know, why are you letting them get away with this, Supreme Court? I have some respect for yourself, so these other people have other courts have respect for you. And I mean, it was pretty poignant and direct. And so if they're human and they have a reaction and it's like, how dare you twist us like this, twist things around again like you did for 12 years after Heller, that's great. But if they say, we'll wait for a case that has a complete record, and I mean, because they do play the long, they don't, you know, but they realizing that they're not necessarily going to get the opportunity to play the long game in these cases, because they need to nail some Second Amendment jurisprudence down sooner rather than later, because later the composition of the court may change.
Absolutely. Now, you brought up the Rahimi case. We expect that decision probably in June. And again, we don't know how narrowly tailored this is going to be. Zaki Rahimi is the guy who was prohibited from owning a firearm because he had a domestic violence restraining order against him. Fifth Circuit concluded that there is no national tradition of barring gun possession for somebody who is subject to a restraining order or something like that, barring a conviction. You know, there are a number of prohibited persons cases that are either sitting there at the Supreme Court waiting for the Rahimi decision and then making their way up through the lower courts. We actually I had to laugh when I saw the Ninth Circuit decision, Chuck, that said that this nonviolent felon does possess the right to keep and bear arms. I agree completely. But it's like, you know, Ninth Circuit, that's the gun owner who you defend, not the other gun owners who are, you know, trying to purchase ammunition without having to go through a background check.
Because you had Judge Van Dyke and Judge Bea on that panel.
Okay.
So it's sad but true that it's almost, let's say, 70% dependent on your judge, what your result's going to be now, which is kind of disheartening, you know, because as a lawyer, I want to make a great argument, bulletproof reasoning. You know, the judges who don't want to strike down a gun control law, you can be F. Lee Bailey on steroids and you're still not going to persuade him of anything.
Right.
But yeah, that was interesting that in the Duarte case, they said that the guy with previous nonviolent felony convictions could not be disarmed as part of the class of felons that can't possess firearms anymore. And I agree, you know, it has to be, if you do anything other than prohibit someone from possessing firearms based on an individualized finding of dangerousness, then you open the door again for the government to misuse the process as they have in the past to disarm a demonized political subclass of people that is politically disfavored. And in the past, that's been used against Catholics, freed slaves, and Indians. So who's the next politically disfavored class? Patriots? MAGA guys? I mean, you know, they can name anybody and you know, say that they are dangerous as a group. So we're going to take the rights away from all of them.
And gun owners in general might be that class, right? Those who dare to exercise their Second Amendment rights. That could be a sign of dangerousness in and of itself, I suppose, if you wanted to, take it to an extreme. So do you think we're going to get pure speculation, but do you think we're going to get a narrow decision in Rahimi? Or do you think this is going to be an attempt to sort of set these lower courts straight about how to conduct the text history and tradition test?
Well, see, my prediction is we're going to lose that battle, but still win the war.
Okay.
Because the battle is over that individual. And they made it very clear at all argument that they're viewing this as an as-applied case. In other words, as applied to this individual, not on its face across the board to all individuals with restraining orders. And so they can write a narrow ruling that only addresses this guy. And he had a hearing on whether or not he should have this restraining order against him, i.e. whether or not he was violent. And so he had that aspect of due process. So they could say, yeah, he was rightfully disarmed. Then the question is, how are they going to walk through their own Bruin test to reach that conclusion? And I think they're going to have to, and perhaps they're going to want to, really expand on and lay out some detail on Bruin. But how much detail? We might see a very fractured decision coming out of the Supreme Court on that, where you get multiple judges taking the opportunity to say more than other judges maybe want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like Alito and Thomas again might want to really say the courts are getting the methodology wrong, the lower courts, because it's basically their first chance to speak about this since Bruin. So, I have all my digits crossed that they clarify things in Rahimi, or they take one of those other cases and, you know, In a perfect world, they'll just take the case and say, hey, lower court, you got this wrong. We don't need briefs or oral argument. We're just vacating your decision and telling you to reconsider it in light of X, Y, Z. That would save us some time.
Right.
You know, they have the authority to do a lot of different things.
All right. Well, and again, we may not know anything on Monday, right? It's entirely possible the orders come out.
I do expect they will not. And again, this is, you know, let's stand at the crap table and roll the dice.
Sure.
I don't think they're going to take or not take any of those cases Monday. Obviously, I could be wrong, and this is not like a 90-10 bet. The odds are probably 50-50. But I think that they're going to punt. Just carry these over to the next conference and maybe carry it over until after Rahimi comes out, rather than either granting or denying cert on Monday.
Oh,
but hey, okay. I'm hoping I'm wrong.
I'm hoping you're wrong too, but I mean, look, Heller, I think went through three conferences before cert was granted. Pretty sure Bruin went through at least two before cert was granted. Right.
So I don't remember, but it's not unusual for any case to go through multiple conferences.
Yeah. All right.
And well, but they're having this is a Second Amendment day. I mean, they have all those cases.
Right. I know. So, well, fingers crossed. I can't do all my digits, but I'll do these. And if you don't mind, if we do get some news from the court next week, you're going to be one of the first people I reach out to come on the show.
Have me back. Absolutely. I will. You know, lawyers like to talk, and I'm a lawyer. So no, I'm happy to. I'm really seriously. I mean, it's going to be no matter what they do, it's going to be a significant development, and it's going to be a sign of what they plan to do going forward. And obviously, every gun owner in the country should be paying attention and asking exactly that. What are they going to do to set the record straight with the lower courts and make them start towing the line?
Absolutely right. Chuck Michel with the California Rifle and Pistol Association, the Second Amendment Law Center as well. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Always a pleasure. See you Monday.
So if we do get a good decision from the Supreme Court on Monday, we do find out that they've granted cert in one or more of these cases. Obviously, we'll be talking about that on Monday's Cam and Company. Either way, we'll give you an update on what happens. The orders from this week's conference will come out on Monday morning. And again, don't be stressed. If you don't see any of these gun ban cases listed or granted cert, it might take more than one conference for that to happen. But what we really don't want to see is just that blanket denial. Where the court has considered these cases and has refused to accept them for consideration at this point in time. Still won't be the end of the story. I mean, as Chuck said, we're still, I won't say the preliminary stages, but we have not yet had these cases decided on the merits. So there is another opportunity to prevail the Supreme Court, but boy, a right delayed is a right denied. And these delays in challenging these gun bans, or at least hearing a gun ban challenge, well, they are having a major impact on the rights of Americans across the country. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Illinois, Hervey City, Illinois, in Macon County, where a dispute over a $50 towing bill led to one person being shot and killed, three others injured. One of those injuries occurred during an act of self-defense. This is, I tell you, it's kind of a crazy story here. Hervey City is a small town in Macon County. And apparently this all sprung about because of a dispute over a towing fee. The suspect in this case, a guy named Timon Perry, was sent to pick up another person's vehicle at a place called Greg's Towing. Greg Hostetler runs the shop. According to local authorities, once Perry arrived on the scene, there was a dispute over the cost of the tow. $50. That verbal altercation turned into a physical altercation, according to Scott Flannery, who's a sheriff in the Macon County Sheriff's Office. He said the suspect pulled out a handgun and then shot Greg Hostetler in the head. Hostetler's nephew 18-year-old Colby Sunderland, then tried to grab the gun away from Perry. Sunderland was shot in the shoulder, but eventually was able to get possession of that gun. Flannery said, basically still being threatened, he fired one round and struck Mr. Perry in the testicular area. The police then arrived at the scene, found Hostetler dead on arrival. Perry taken to the hospital for his injuries. He's been charged with first-degree murder. Sunderland, I think, is going to recover from his injury. He was, again, shot in the shoulder, but not expected to be a life-threatening injury. Now, police say prior to the shooting, Timon Perry had a warrant out for his arrest. He is on probation right now. He was sentenced to 24 months probation for unlawful vehicular invasion, which is another way to describe a carjacking. And he got 2 years probation for that offense. To make matters even worse, authorities say that Perry, earlier this year, did not attend a meeting with his probation officer, skipped a court date. So in April, last month, an arrest warrant was issued for him for failing to abide by the terms of his probation. Law enforcement also notes that Perry's previously faced charges of armed robbery with a firearm, as well as aggravated assault of a peace officer. News Channel 20 spoke to the Macon County State's attorney about the process of taking somebody with active warrants into custody. And he said, and this is important, because again, I think some people in this country, not you, you know better, but I think there are a lot of folks in this country who think that when a warrant is issued, the APBs go out, right? Bolo alerts are sent, the helicopters go up in the air, and there's that's not what happens. This is a pretty rural county we're talking about here, Macon County. And the state's attorney, Scott Reuter, said, with a technical violation of not reporting, that's not something that raises a lot of alarms. In other words, you fail to show up to meet with your probation officer. I mean, yeah, it's a technical violation, but they're not going to do anything about it. He went on to say, if there's some other indication that he was acting out in a violent manner, even though it was a violation of probation for a technical basis, then we would be more concerned. So it doesn't matter if you have a previous criminal history that's violent, right? Doesn't matter if you've been accused of armed robbery, aggravated assault of a police officer, carjacking, and now you're on probation and you skip out on that probation. Meh, it's still just seen as sort of a technical violation, right? It's a paperwork offense. So, no. Just because somebody has a warrant out for their arrest doesn't mean that law enforcement is actively looking for them. If they run across them, they'll take them into custody. But in Illinois, and this isn't just Illinois specific, I mean, this really does apply in every state of the union. And somebody who is wanted by police can go on to commit other crimes, because being wanted doesn't mean that you're actively being sought. Now, in this case, I would argue that Mr. Perry should not have received 2 years probation for his vehicular invasion. But again, this is unfortunately what happens all too often in the state of Illinois, where the Democratic majority in the legislature is soft on crime and really, really tough on law-abiding legal gun owners. Today's Armed Citizen story from Beaumont, Texas, where a burglary suspect was held at gunpoint by a church deacon this Tuesday. That suspect has now been identified. It was, again, a Tuesday about 10:30 in the morning. Quentin Grant, who's a deacon at Impact Ministries, showed up at the church, and he said he knew that something wasn't right when he pulled in. You can see one of the church speakers sitting in an entryway behind the glass door of the front of the church. And so he said, oh, that speaker's not supposed to be there. So he drew his gun. Before he went inside the church, drew his gun, walked inside, flipped a breaker, all the lights come on, and he sees a stranger walking towards him. That stranger, identified as 45-year-old Leon Goodman. Quentin Grant told Goodman, get down on the floor, pulled out his phone, called 911. Held Goodman at gunpoint until officers arrived at the church. He said that he had gone there to do some cleaning in his office when he found Goodman burglarizing the building. Yet the speaker and a spotlight that he'd removed from a wall. There was a fan and some other electronic equipment that he was ready to carry out, apparently. Police officers said that Goodman was known to them as well. He has a prior list of convictions. So, yeah, this could have been our deal of the day, too. 1999, convicted of burglary of a building. He was sentenced to 4 years probation. In 2000, his probation was revoked. He was sentenced to a year behind bars. In 2010, he was convicted of manufacturing and delivering a controlled substance, sentenced to 10 months in the state jail, or in a county jail. 2014, once again, convicted of possession of a controlled substance, sentenced to 2 years in prison. And just last year, convicted of possession of a controlled substance and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Now, that was just last year. He's already out. Police have taken him into custody once again. And probably at least a little bit of jail time in Mr. Goodman's future if he is convicted or pleads guilty to this crime. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Pickleball angels. That's right. Pickleball players who saved a man who ended a cardiac arrest in Chesterfield, Virginia, one of the Richmond suburbs. This happened a couple weeks ago. But the pickleball angels in question, I don't think I can ever get tired of saying that phrase, were honored last night during the Chesterfield Board of Supervisors meeting. Wayne Latimer was the individual who suffered a cardiac event. And the pickleball angels, including Karen Kent, helped to save his life. She said that she was on the court when other players called out for help. She said, "I hear Karen." And I'm like, "What?" And she said, "Like, Karen, he's down." Then she realized that Wayne Latimer was in cardiac arrest. She said, "I just went running over to the court. He was laying on the court. He was breathing erratically. And within a second, he stopped breathing." Now, Karen Kent is a nurse, so she started performing CPR on Latimer. But there were also a couple of portable AED devices, the defibrillator devices, that had been installed on the courts just not long ago, actually. Karen Kent says when he received that shock is when he actually got a heartbeat back. She said it was a really nice group effort between EMTs and all the friends that came to help. She said the AEDs made the difference. And Neil Luther, who's the director of the Chesterfield Parks and Recreation, said the Pickleball Club of Chesterfield spearheaded the effort several years ago. They actually purchased the two units on their own. And then we realized that this was a good idea. So now the county is installing these defibrillators at parks across the county. They've gotten 23 new artificial defibrillator devices installed, all in a public setting in various parks throughout the county, which is a good thing. But again, that was prompted not by the actions of big government, but by volunteers, by people who thought, hey, you know what? Got a lot of folks active in this area. Might be a good idea to have one of these things around. Let's raise the money and do it ourselves. During Wednesday's meeting, Wayne Latimer said, "I think I'm here today because of Karen and all of the pickleball angels that helped me." And I think he's right, honestly. I confess, I am neutral on pickleball. I have never played pickleball. I have no desire to play pickleball. But I am glad that when Wayne Latimer was playing pickleball, that there were some guardian angels there on the court in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing and to save his life. So, Pickleball Angels of Chesterfield, Virginia, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Now, we are going to have a lot to discuss on Monday and on Tuesday of next week, too. So, we've got the NRA annual meeting coming up in Dallas this weekend. I will not be in attendance, unfortunately. I'm not going to be able to travel down there. But Saturday's members meeting and Monday's board of directors meeting, those, again, two very, very big, important meetings when it comes to the future of the NRA. So we'll be talking about that at least a little bit on Monday's show, the members meeting. The board meeting will be taking place while we are doing the show. So we'll probably have some more coverage for you on Tuesday as well. But we will also, again, on Monday, be giving you an update on what happens, if anything, at the Supreme Court with these gun ban cases. So I would encourage you to tune in on Monday. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com. Between now and then, we are constantly updating the website with the latest Second Amendment news and information that you need to know about. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. All you have to do is go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get 50% off your VIP or VIP Gold membership. You'll get exclusive content. You'll get an ad-free experience. You'll be able to comment on all of our stories. If you become a VIP Gold member, you'll get that across the entire Town Hall Media family of websites. So Red State, Hot Air, PJ Media, townhall.com. There is a ton of great VIP exclusive content available there. It is well worth it. I would encourage you to check it out. Again, use the promo code SAVEAMERICA and get 50% off of your membership. We'll see you back here on Monday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.